Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. 2 weeks ago, we began a program on criminal justice reform. In our first installment, just 2 weeks after Bay Area communities held local primary elections, where San Francisco voters overwhelmingly endorsed Proposition H, recalling progressive district attorney Chesa Boudin, and at the same time, in neighboring counties, voters turned away from relatively liberal sheriffs in favor of a candidate touting progressive reforms. And in two other counties, contested races for district attorneys resulted in the re-election of incumbents with differing policies on criminal justice. And in this program, we discussed the implications of that election for Bay Area politics and the local face of law enforcement. Tonight, we pick up where we left off, and we discuss the mood of the electorate and the implications of the election for criminal justice reform efforts statewide. In recent years, criminal justice reforms have become a virtual whipping boy amongst anti-crime activists, blaming such reforms as the reduction of nonviolent drug possessory offenses and small theft offenses from felonies to misdemeanors, and blaming them for a rise in crimes, ranging from drug dealing to residential burglaries, each of which actually remain punishable as felonies, to say nothing of smash-and-grab retail thefts and automobile burglaries. Did recent reforms go too far, or are they getting bad press? Is the correlation between these reforms and the spike in crime being misrepresented? Some would point to the imprecise draftsmanship and an absence of anti-recidivism provisions to suggest we need to tidy up some of these reforms. At the same time, others would suggest that these reforms mightn't go far enough, that branding a young adult offender with felonies for a single nonviolent transgression often results in lifelong disabilities that prevent people from obtaining professional licenses, perhaps in their 30s and 40s and beyond. Tonight, we're discussing criminal justice reform policies. This is a hot topic with passionate arguments from multiple perspectives. Of course, we want you, our most important guest, to be part of this conversation. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area. Otherwise, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that just as a physician won't diagnose your family member based on a phone call, our attorney guest can't provide you precise legal advice as they lack all the facts relating to a given case. However, we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist in your decision-making. And while their legal guidance might not be the positions of their employers or clients, our attorney guests are here to help. Tonight, we have a truly outstanding panel of guests, each of whom approaches these issues from a unique and highly informed perspective. Damone Hale is an attorney and social justice activist practicing out of San Francisco. Damone practices criminal defense for over 30 years. A former San Francisco assistant district attorney and past member of the board of directors of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and also, like myself, a past chair of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, criminal defense attorney Randall Knox has been a force to be reckoned with in San Francisco legal circles for some 35 years. A 28-year veteran Santa Clara County prosecutor, Jay Boyarski, has served as chief assistant district attorney under Santa Clara County District Attorney Jeff Rosen since 2010. Before joining the office, Mr. Boyarski clerked for United States District Judge William Ingram. Judge Eugene Hyman served on the Superior Court of Santa Clara County for some 20 years. He is the first American to receive the United Nations Public Service Award. Judge Hyman helped create and serves in the field of therapeutic jurisprudence, a philosophy that advocates treatment for particular categories of offenders, such as domestic violence. And to all of our guests, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Oh, good to be here.
So the last time we were here, we were talking about these elections and the changing faces in law enforcement. Tonight, I would like to move on, and while that's still on the table for anyone who wishes to speak of it, what I really wanted to talk about tonight are policies and criminal justice reform. And where should criminal justice reform go? Looking out since the 1980s and 90s, crime rates have dropped. And even now, even with the spike in crime, it's still lower than what was happening in the 80s and 90s. What was behind that decline? Was it longer prison sentences or tougher policing or something else? Randall Knox, you look like you're ready to jump in.
Well, I don't know. I was waiting for the judge. You defer to the bench first. I mean, I was looking at, when I saw the topic on the outline you sent us, I tried to look up. I always thought that it was the demographics of spikes in the population between 18 and 25 that seemed to commit the most crimes. And that seemed to be the kids of the boomers in the 80s and 90s. Combined with the economy, and obviously crack. But I'd like to hear what other people have to say about it.
Judge Hyman, you've had the gauntlet thrown down. Why don't you join in?
Well, tell us
a little bit about why these rates have dropped.
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I agree with Mr. Knox in part that the demographics have a lot to do with it. People do age out of crime, no question about it. The average juvenile ages out of crime. I think where drug usage is down, we have more therapeutic interventions that are working now. That is the use of drug treatment courts, mental health courts, veterans courts, and other kinds of therapeutic courts. And those are things that we didn't have in the 80s, and they save lives, they change lives. So I think it's not one thing. I think it's a combination of things.
Pedophiles don't age out of crime, but that's a very small percentage of people that are in state prison. But with that significant caveat, I agree with what Judge Hyman said. But when it comes to pedophilic child molesters, they don't age out of crime. But people who are committing assaults, murders, bank robberies, street crime, yeah, they tend to age out of crime.
You know, years ago, I remember having a Romero motion. And for listeners, that's a motion to strike, a strike prayer involving somebody in his early 40s. He was there for a nonviolent drug possessory offense back when they were still felonies. And while he talked about really reaching a turning point and wanted to turn his life around, there was very little to back it up. And a very conservative judge looked up and said, yes, but there's something unique about turning 40. And I hear that in your words. And this judge, last person in the world I would have expected it from, wisely granted this motion and struck his prior, which meant treated his case as if he didn't have the strike prior. And gave him a chance at probation. This person did succeed and turn his life around. The judge may have channeled something with him, may have picked up on something more subtle than I. But it proved there's some wisdom in what you're saying about, in certain low-level offenses, there's really something about somebody turning the corner age-wise.
Well, I think also that we have a tendency to file felonies when in certain instances there isn't a need for a crime to be a felony. And the reason why that concerns me is that if you do a review of professional licenses, everything from manicurist to barber to lawyer, accountant, physician, usually once a felony, always a felony, even if a charge is later reduced to a misdemeanor. You know, when we talk about striking strikes, the ability to strike a strike has been a judicial appellate remedy that was found based upon equal protection in terms of that the prosecutor could do it, but at least as the proposition and the statutes were written, judges couldn't. So on a multiple theories, the Supreme Court said judges have the opportunity to strike strikes. But if you look at how what is required to strike a strike versus what is required to reduce a felony to a misdemeanor, assuming that it can be pursuant to Section 17B, the remedy to reduce from a felony to a misdemeanor is a lot more liberal under 17B than it is under the ability to strike strikes. One of the things that I wish that I had realized much earlier in my career is the consequences of wearing a felony, even if it was later reduced to a misdemeanor. And if I had life to do over again as a judge, I would have reduced more felonies to misdemeanors at the beginning. Usually the way it's done is that you have to earn the reduction. But by sustaining a felony as a felony and not as a misdemeanor, you are potentially affecting someone's ability to engage in one of possibly 200 in California licenses. Now, are there some people that deserve felonies? Absolutely, especially the violent people. I have absolutely no problem at all with that. But people that have clean records, that do an occasional stupid thing. Back in the olden days, it was, of course, substance abuse, because most drugs were felonies until Prop 47 was passed, 57. It just isn't helpful, I don't think, for basically to give someone a scarlet A for the rest of their lives. That's my opinion.
You've really brought up multiple topics. I'd like to break that down a little bit. One of them that I wanted to hold off until a bit later has to do with rehabilitation. And perhaps we're not allowing the level of rehabilitation that we think we are. And I want to break that out for the second half of the show, because that carries a lot more meat to the topic than some of what we've been talking about. The other part has to do with how we should treat the offenses in the first place and what's going to have an effect on crime and what's going to have an effect on life in the community. And the obvious nexus is that if the crime's down, the community is probably happier and healthier. But then the next tier is the more that you're slowing people from participating in the community, the more you're holding them back, the more likely they are, at least on the margin, that some of them will turn to crime. Damone, I haven't had a chance to get you in on the conversation yet on this topic. Jump in.
Sure. You know, I've been blessed to have worked in the Bayview Hunters Point community and have served that community for all of my legal career. So a little over 31 years, born and raised in Compton, California. So the work that I do is not just a job. I think first, and you know, when you used and highlighted child molest, I've only tried one life case in Sacramento, and the jury hung 8-4, 7-5, not guilty. DA elected not to refile. We settled the case. My client was given 1,000-plus hours of community service. The public defender, I remember, giving me a call, indicating how much that's helped them in resolving such cases. If there's one issue about guilt, and then there's an issue about, you know, what do we do once that's determined? If we're serious about trying to solve problems, then we've got to use, I think, smart policies, therapeutic services. It's not a question. You know, the issue of violence, You know, it's one thing to have somebody on probation. It's, you know, one thing to have them go do 52 weeks of a, you know, program. But if they don't have the tools to use back in the community, then our community continues to have those same problems reoccur. So for me, you know, there has to be some transition from our system of criminal justice to solving our problems that created those mistakes. And so with respect to, you know, child molest, I wish that never existed, but I had a prosecutor, Pat Ector. She would call me in and have me work with her child victims to tell them about the court process, what defense attorneys would do, because it helped that child not be traumatized again. And if we can take off our hats sometimes and look at what we are really trying to do, I think we have a greater impact. And I think that's the part that's missing, that counselor part. When I first started practice, you know, and I, you know, in Bayview at the foundation, we had human services, we had substance abuse. So as an attorney, I was trained that when I had a client, I had to evaluate whether they had mental health issues, substance abuse, and then I was required as that attorney to tie them into the services our foundation provided. And then obviously present that to the court. That was back when I started in 1990, before they used terms like wraparound services and all these buzzwords. That community figured out how to work effectively. We missed that. You know, the politics, you know, and I know we'll probably talk about Chessa, but that was part of his undoing, was that his big heart, he didn't realize that there's a certain way to be effective. And you've got to show it. You got to be able to, and, you know, I thought it was a missed opportunity. Anyway.
Jay, you were nodding. Do you agree with that? That's a big part of it, not knowing quite how to plug in and be effective?
Yeah, well, we probably don't need to go back and talk about all the ways that Chessa sort of blew it or missed his opportunity, or whether he had a big heart or was just a bad politician. But looking at the big picture, 10 years ago, there were tens of thousands of more people, we're talking about men primarily, in the California prison system. I believe mass incarceration is a big problem, but we ought to recognize when progress is being made. And if you go from 180,000 people in state prison down to 110,000 people in state prison, that's a really dramatic decrease. And if you think about the benefits to those individuals, their families, and to the community and to the economy, to the extent that they are not recidivating, going back to prison, that's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? And crime has not skyrocketed and spiked the way many people, including many of my colleagues in the law enforcement area, kept predicting through all these reforms, many of which my boss Jeff Rosen supported, not all of them. It was always, this is the end of the world. The end of the world is coming. Crime is going to skyrocket. It hasn't. Crime is up. Violent crime is up 10% this year, which is horrible, but it's well below the historical levels that we've seen over the past few decades. So one of the things that criminal justice reformers need to keep an eye on is what's practical, what's going to work. We in Santa Clara County DA's office are constantly expanding our resentencing opportunities for people who were sent to prison, who received excessive sentences, many of whom have probably now aged out of crime, and they deserve a chance. Some criminal justice reformers seem to have it backwards. As soon as the person is arrested for a violent crime, they think that they can solve the mass incarceration problem by not sending this recently dangerous and violent person to crime. To prison when they really need to go to prison. The opportunities to reduce the prison population are among the people who have already been there for 15, 20, 25, and 30 years. not the people who are 19 and 20 or 25 and are shooting people and raping people and murdering people, and say, hey, we shouldn't send those people to prison for very many years. I think that just has it absolutely backwards.
Well, it may have it backwards. I don't disagree with what you're saying. What's missing in the analysis is we've done all these things as a state to reduce the numbers, to work out a quantitative solution. What I think is missing is the qualitative solution. I still think we lack a good sense of balance, a good sense of using discretion to figure out on a charge or even facts of an arrest that might have been charged as a felony or misdemeanor. It seems that different entities, different prosecutors in different counties are locked into the idea that we're going to approach all of these as misdemeanors, or we're going to approach all of these things as felonies. You'll find tremendous discrepancies. You could have somebody at the southern end of San Francisco who commits what's been a misdemeanor time and time again in San Francisco. The nearest entity to San Francisco, whether it's Daly City on the west side or Brisbane on the east side, finds that these people are not even in San Mateo County, but they're within the 500 yards they're allowed to go into San Francisco. And suddenly they're in a completely different place where these misdemeanors are looked at as felonies. And it seems that the case-by-case discretion, just because we can charge it a particular way, doesn't mean it's applicable to this case, is sorely lacking. Does anybody want to agree? Anybody disagree?
Jeff, I completely agree with you, but you're talking about something that is at the fundamental basis of American society and American government. And we can, right? I mean, things have dramatically changed for women in the last few weeks in Mississippi and Alabama and Texas in really, really bad ways. But they haven't changed for women in California and Oregon and Washington. That's because we have different states that are doing things differently. And we have 58 counties in California. And in Imperial County, the voters, or at least the district attorney, they view crimes one way. And by the way, they tend to be heavy consumers of prison beds in these rural counties. I've known rural district attorneys to unfortunately brag, we don't have any drug treatment in such and such county. And I think it's absolutely backwards. Whereas in Santa Clara County or Santa Barbara County or Yolo County or Sacramento County, you have a different sort of view. But the governor of California has to deal with the fact that he has 58 different district attorneys. Where are you? Are you going to change the whole system so there is no discretion amongst the different counties? I think it's just a structural problem in a way.
Well, you use the word discretion in the individual counties. I'm all for discretion. Not the distinction between the counties, I think, is built in our Constitution, and I think it should be. My question, and I'll pose this next to Judge Hyman or to Randall Knox.
I'm going to interrupt. You're a public defender. You're only in favor of discretion when it means giving someone accused of a crime less time.
Not actually true.
No one likes discretion when the district attorney says, yeah, I'm exercising my discretion. I think this person should get more time.
Now, Jay, you and I disagree, and I do private cases as well as court-appointed cases. But the point being, I don't always like it as somebody who lives in the community when that discretion is exercised to release somebody who I think clearly should not be out in the streets any more than when it faces my client and they're not exercising the discretion to say, wait a minute, maybe the elements of an offense are met, but the facts just don't warrant it. When you have somebody committing a residential burglary where the elements are met, but they're in a carport behind a building where part of a balcony overhangs it, so it meets the definition of a residential burglary, even though for all intents and purposes, they're in the backyard and never entered the place. And yet they're facing a serious felony because of the dangers inherent in breaking into somebody's house. I would like somebody to look at that and decide, is this situation, is this person's record such that we want to hang that offense on him? And if the answer is no, somebody should have the good sense to say, no, this may be a crime, this may be a theft, but maybe not a residential burglary. And I'm not asking for leniency. I want somebody to look at every single case they're filing and make a decision what this warrants. What are we going to do for this person's future, for better or for worse? Randy Knox, take a couple minutes. We don't have much time before the break, but I'd really like to get your input on this.
Okay, and I think that you've hit the nail on the head that the system is set up for people processing, not the individualized assessment of somebody's malevolence or likelihood of rehabilitation. And you're right, when people end up going to prison, they don't get rehabilitated. And like, I don't know if it was Jay last week or someone else who said, you know, crime follows poverty. So you end up with people who don't feel like they're invested in the system, who don't think that it works for them. So there's really no reason why they feel they need to be lawful. I know I'm going off on a tangent here, but you're right. If you can assess the individualized characteristics of the human being, but it takes more time. It's too labor intensive. And as Judge Hyman will say, you've got to move the calendar. I'm not saying that you were like that, Judge, but I mean, you know, it takes more time to determine how should we treat this crime and this person than a judge just to say it's a first degree burglary, mandatory state prison.
Judge Hyman, take about a minute or two before we go to break. How do you feel about that? How do we pump discretion into the system?
Well, you know, everyone wants a biased judge, biased either defense or prosecution. They'll take a fair neutral partial.
Judge, I believe you're off mic. If you could lean into it a little more.
Can you hear me now?
Much better.
All right, thanks. the public understands sort of a concept of fair, neutral, and impartial. The parties, whether it be civil or criminal, they want biased judges as long as they're biased in their favor. They'll take a fair, neutral, and impartial judge as a default if they can't get one that's biased in their favor. Having judicial elections, in my view, makes it much more difficult for judges to really be proactive, because judges, rightly or wrongly, are very concerned about facing contested elections. I can only speak for myself, but whenever I had a hard decision, one of my fears was that, you know, this guy gets out and then murders someone or is driving under the influence and kills someone. And in my picture is on the front page. I acknowledged it and moved on, because my responsibility is to do the right thing and not be concerned about whether some prosecutor is going to run against me. But that's a political reality. So if we really want judges to be independent, we need to do away with judicial elections. And that's probably not going to happen.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're discussing talking about criminal justice reforms in the system in view of the last election and a perceived spike in crime. Just what does this do for criminal justice reform? Where are we getting it right? Where are we getting it wrong? My guests tonight are retired Judge Eugene Hyman, San Francisco Attorney Randall Knox, Chief Assistant Santa Clara County District Attorney Jay Boyarsky, and San Francisco attorney and social justice activist Damone Hale. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about the justice system. You want to talk about criminal justice reform. You don't have to jump in the exact point we may be in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So, one of the things that we're talking about are recent reforms in criminal justice. And who wants to talk a little bit about some of the recent reforms? I mean, we've seen a lot of offenses that get reduced from felonies to misdemeanors, legalization of marijuana, reduction from felony to misdemeanor of most marijuana trafficking or most drug possession. Can you walk us? Who'd like to walk us through a little bit of that, Judge Hyman?
I'm not an expert on that. I can only say that the problem with propositions, and this is all propositions, Prop 13, Prop 47, Prop 57, is that whenever you have a proposition, you don't have the legislative give and take. You don't have things vetted by the various players that have an interest. And as a result, you always have a proposition that has a problem. And I think that 47 is an example of a proposition that I supported because I thought it had more good than bad. But there's problems with 47 in terms of recidivism that needs to be changed so that if you're committing a lot of crimes, they need to become felonies at some point. And presently under the current legislation, it stays a misdemeanor. And I don't think that's particularly helpful. Do I think that that has contributed to crime in and of itself? No, I don't. And I'm unaware of any study that says that it does.
Wasn't three strikes a proposition also? And that didn't
seem
to reduce crime.
Absolutely. And there's problems with that. Absolutely. That has subsequently been modified by a couple of propositions. But even so, it's not perfect. I mean, legislating by propositions is far from perfect because you just don't have the process of investigation and give and take and the opportunity to be heard by everyone who has a position to take.
Although looking at three strikes, we refer to it as the three strikes law, but it's actually two parallel three strikes laws. The voters were working towards one, and in the wake of a horrific crime, the legislature could not move fast enough to make a parallel provision. And they're almost identical, although the legislative one limits custody credits and reaches a bit further even than the voter initiative. They've been pared back some, but again, there's no sense of balance in the measure as written. Subsequent changes in the legislature seem to have helped. Judicial decisions have helped. But again, there's what's written is pretty concrete.
There's a statute that just came on that deals with on diversion, judicial diversion. And there have been three recent court of appeals that have categorically concluded that misdemeanor defendants with DUI charges are not eligible for judicial diversion. When you look at the legislative intent behind the statute 23, I believe, 264, that prohibits misdemeanor defendants from participating in diversion. When you look at the intent the legislature talks about, it truly is about recidivism. It's about really identifying those who are chemically dependent. The intent even talks about how first offenders, half of them are chemically dependent, meaning the other half just had a, you know, they went out, they drank, and if they were offered diversion, we would never see them again. But because the requirements of the court to really look at that defendant, and they talk about it in the legislation, that the legislature has to provide more resources for courts to do screenings, et cetera, to determine who's chemically dependent. If we could, now with the court of opinions as they stand today, what we know is there'll be no changes. So all of the drunk driving, multiple offenders, our system is going to continue to create them. So the question becomes whether or not we do the hard work. And then we were talking a little bit about that. Yeah, judges, we have found when we looked at disproportionate minority confinement, in order to address that issue, the courts, the judges specifically, had to be the driving force. So if we're talking about, for example, drunk drivers, if we had judges, and I use Judge Goodman, Larry Goodman, retired Judge Goodman from Alameda County, he created a diversion program called Crossroads, which he managed. And he managed it, I think, not only with, seriousness, but he also showed care for the participants. Now, I don't know what the numbers are, but I know my two clients that were in it, that were allowed to be in it, were successful. And one of them, the judge told him before trial, I'm going to send you to prison. It worked. He terminated my client early. But it took the judge really getting into the Kool-Aid of these individuals. So now we have three court of appeals that says, nope, these individuals will not be allowed to be, have the carrot of diversion, the carrot of not having a conviction. And that is, what makes the system work, when somebody can see a benefit. Right now, my clients don't see a benefit. And if I can't create one, meaning, hey, this is how we get you from A to B, they will be back. So
I don't know if that was Jay or someone else sent me an article about LA, the diversion programs, how a number of people, it was Jay, declined to participate in it because it's too burdensome for them and they'd rather have a misdemeanor conviction. I think you need to try to incentivize rehabilitation.
We had a judge in San Mateo. He's been retired for several years. I won't mention names, but he started with the best of intentions of giving people all sorts of programs to do as conditions of probation. He meant well. The problem is he set people up to fail because people have lives. And when they leave, they have an AA program to do 5 of the 7 days of the week. They have various volunteer work to do. They have all these things. How do they earn a living? How do they take care of their kids? How do they find time to sleep 5-6 hours a night? We have to balance this with being able to take care of our own human needs. But yet,
Jeff,
go ahead.
Maybe before we turn to phone calls, I think I read in the LA Times that the state had a budget surplus of about $100 billion. We know that fluctuates based on how the stock market does and wealthy people getting hit with their capital gains and feast or famine in California. We know what we could do to reduce crime if we wanted to spend the money. We know what we could do to reduce homelessness and addiction. What we need to do is build probably 70 or 80 facilities all over the state of California that would have a locked, secure component, which people on the left would hate, civil libertarians would hate. And it would have tons of job counseling, tons of outpatient treatment, tons of work training, tons of classes, which people on the right would probably hate. Why are we throwing all this money after people that have committed crimes instead of spending it on other people who haven't done anything wrong? But if the state wanted to spend that surplus on these sorts of community centers and actually force you know, we as a society are allowing homelessness to be a blight on this state, and everybody's just complaining about it, but nobody wants to do anything about it. As the, I think it's, who's the mayor of Sacramento? Steinberg?
Daryl Steinberg.
Right now. He says there we ought to guarantee a fundamental human right is to be sheltered. And I think that's true. And we need to provide shelter, safe, secure shelter for people. But when people then refuse it, as many, many thousands of people would, because they don't like it or they don't like the rules or it's not to their liking, or they have drug addiction or mental health problems that make them want to go live on the street, we cannot let them do that. So we let people do it. You see, so there are solutions out there, but people don't like those solutions on both sides of the political spectrum. But we know that if you make drug treatment available for people, a lot of people are going to take advantage of it. A lot of people aren't unless you force them to. And people say, well, you can't force someone to succeed in drug treatment. You know how many people I know that have gotten out of prison who said prison saved my life? Now, I'm not saying prison is rehabilitative. Believe me, it's not. It's the prisons in California are not rehabilitative and bad. But why is it always an either or? Why is it go to prison, to a horrible prison where you're going to come out worse, or don't go even to jail and we'll let you live under the freeway for as long as you want and just commit petty crimes and wander around defecating without any pants on? Why aren't we willing to adopt sort of a middle ground approach here? You know why? Because it would cost billions of dollars. The state has billions of dollars. The state doesn't even want to fund judges. They're not even funding judges in California. So I know it's complicated. Crime rates, it goes up and down. It's demographic. It's not all about legislation, but there's no real will to want to solve these things. People just want to complain about them.
So Jay, one of the things when we were reforming juvenile justice, one of the things Attorney James Bell, through his work with the Annie Casey Foundation, what they realized, for example, if you have youth that are, you have a spike in theft crimes, economic crimes, then the solution is more after-school jobs, employment training. And that's what we did. We moved from a detention-based model to a community supervision model. And we had to make sure that we had varying degrees of supervision levels. So intensive home-based supervision programs were for kids that we knew would get into. Now, we're taking, the hardcore is still in custody. So we're not talking about that crew. But we are talking about a large number of youngsters that would have been detained because we didn't have in the community the kinds of programs that, one, the kids wanted to go to. That's the other thing. Kids are easy. I used to teach high school. Kids are easy. If you create a little fun, you can attract the majority of them. The rest of those little ones, the ones that don't, then we can focus on them with the other resources in the community. This is not rocket science. It's just that it takes time. I don't have any kids, but I can tell you, I've taken hundreds of kids across this country from Bayview. And I can tell you some success stories and some failures, but I can tell you that it took all of us on weekends. You can't just expect a kid to go to a group session once a week and then they're going to be okay. Just isn't going to work. So
you're exactly right.
You know, Jay, you missed a broadcast we had a few weeks ago where we were talking about the mental health system, some of the resources that are not being provided in some counties and are being used in others successfully, where you have the power to conserve people that suffer from mental illness, not necessarily drug abuse, but underlying mental illness that prevents them from being able to provide for their needs of food, clothing, and shelter. Perhaps that's something to look more carefully at before we start chucking away the civil liberties and incarcerating or locking up people involuntarily because they're homeless.
I couldn't agree more with you, Jeff. It is incredibly difficult to have someone conserved, which in my opinion, is a direct overreaction to the abuses that were in the California mental health system in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. So now the pendulum swings too far. And now to get one person a month conserved in a county of 2 million people, it's onerous. It's incredibly difficult.
Well, I take it back. It sounds like you did listen to our show a few weeks ago. We were talking about exactly that. Judge?
I'm in total agreement with Mr. Boyarsky. I had the probate assignment for about 18 months, and there's two kinds of conservatorships. One is the LPS, which is the more of the mental health, and the other is dementia, brain injury, that kind of thing. And the public guardian handles those people with the mental health issues, and those people with dementia that don't have family members that are willing to step up. The problem is that if they're not going to be detained, if they're not going to be in a mental health facility, the public guardian is not in favor of conserving them. And I tried to work out a program with Judge Manley, who does a lot of therapeutic courts in Santa Clara County. And I just couldn't find a way legally to compel the public guardian to do things my way. And it was funding, because there was a different funding stream if people were in mental health facilities versus conserved, but in the community. And now I appreciate that getting people to take medication in the community is a real challenge. But as you may, people on this call or our guests may recall, New York City had a very successful program until it was cut economically, where psychiatrists would go out in the community, assess a number of homeless people in terms of the diagnosis. Then they had psych techs go out in the community every day to give them their medication, which was not forced. It was, you know, most of them took it. And when they started taking their meds, they were able to use other community resources, and a lot of them became, they weren't homeless. So I think this is all possible. And since a lot of homeless people do have mental health issues, they need help. And I agree with Mr. Boyarsky, we're not giving it to them.
I think we all agree on that. And the question is how to go from point A to point B. And I think rewriting the LPS laws would be a good start. Somewhere there has to be a balance, where for those that are seriously mentally ill, we can address some of their needs and help get them on the straight and narrow. And perhaps those laws need to be rewritten to give better guidance so you don't have such radically different results in places where it's either lock them up or forget about them. They shouldn't be receiving their primary treatment in the criminal justice system.
Well, I think that Scott Wiener 2 years ago passed or had a bill that passed the assembly and the Senate, signed into law that expanded the conservatorship law. And my memory is it was targeted for about 50 to 100 people, at least in San Francisco, who were so severely and gravely disabled that they couldn't care for themselves. But my impression, I read something in the paper a couple of months ago that only 4 people had been conserved over those 2 years. So it's like what Jay said, you can't, it's too difficult. And I can't say why it is, but it is.
I noticed differing results in different counties. San Mateo is one of the few that's fairly assertive. I won't quite say aggressive, but they're fairly assertive compared to San Francisco, where public health in terms of conservatorships is almost absentee. And you look at Santa Clara, where it's very difficult to conserve one person to the point where they're going to be deprived of that level of services. It's just the differences between different counties is as absurd as it is in criminal justice. I do want to move on to one or two other items before we start closing out. I did want to ask about something we touched on earlier, which is how to inject discretion We talked about some of the disabilities that people suffer from a felony conviction and how long they can last. And I know, Judge Hyman, from talking with you outside of the broadcast, you have some ideas in that regard. Would you like to explain the scenario? What's the problem and what can we do about it?
Well, number one, as it stands now, the regulatory agencies that do licensing, the legislature has given all these boards and commissions, approximately 200 of them, total discretion to basically decide the admission standards to these professions. And what the average person doesn't understand is that if they get sealing of their records, that the application stayed on the applications to an application, that if you had record sealing, that you are still required to disclose your complete record. And you have banned the box in civil situations, but not in licensure or governmental employment. And we need to modify Section 17B of the Penal Code, where if you get the sealing that's allowed as a result of reduction of a felony to a misdemeanor, that it's a misdemeanor for all purposes. The discretion that these regulatory agencies are given is profound, where basically if you've committed a felony, even if it was later reduced to misdemeanor, you'll never be in these professions for the rest of your life. And I just don't think that's what is a society that we want to be promoting.
So someone who may have possessed drugs or committed a theft in their teens might not be able to work as a doctor or nurse in their 40s.
Well, especially if it was drugs, clearly. Now, granted, because of the law change, simple possession is a misdemeanor. But even then, I can tell you this much. Let's say you want to be a member of the bar and you were convicted of possession of heroin or cocaine or something like that, you might pass the bar, you might pass the background in terms of fitness, but you're going to have to see an addiction specialist in order to be admitted, because even though this happened a long time ago, they're going to want to make sure that this isn't an issue. And it would be the same thing if you had a conviction for driving under the influence prior to trying to become admitted to the bar. They're going to want to make sure. Whereas if you had been a member of the bar and you then pick up a driving under the influence, you might be placed on probation, but you're not going to be prohibited from an occupation.
Anybody want to weigh in on that before we close out? What this means to local communities and incentives of people to stay on the straight and narrow?
Oh, criminal records. Oh, that's the albatross around their neck. It's the, you know, it's a barrier, employment barriers, from that, whether it is education, you know, there's a number of things. And like I said, it's not rocket science. Jobs will settle a lot of our problems. Jobs. And then handling this group of our special neighbors that have mental health challenges becomes a whole lot easier.
Yeah. Jeff Rosen, my boss, the Santa Clara County District Attorney, just implemented a widespread program to expunge criminal convictions, misdemeanors, and felonies for tens of thousands of people who are no longer on probation. And here's the thing that we did differently in Santa Clara County, because we're in Silicon Valley. We wrote software code that would do this automatically with the criminal records database. We didn't just have a press conference like they do in some big cities in California and say, this is what we're going to do, and then never do it. We actually implemented a program where now instantly tens of thousands of people who had convictions in Santa Clara County decades ago have had their felony convictions expunged and cleared. They didn't have to contact a lawyer. They didn't have to go back to their public defender. They didn't have to wait in line at court. the courthouses that are shut down half the time because of lack of funding. We did it automatically because of all the reasons that Damone Hale was just saying. These are examples of positive criminal justice reform that do not lead to car break-ins and organized shoplifting at shopping centers. What it leads to is gainful employment and people paying taxes.
I don't want for a moment to belittle or besmirch that effort. It's a huge effort, and it's a wonderful thing. Judge Hyman, do you think it's enough?
No. I think it's wonderful, but no. I think we need to be smart at the very beginning. I like diversion, but diversion has to be earned. I don't want to just say, hey, you get free misdemeanors or free felonies. I want diversion. Drug treatment courts work, mental health courts work, driving under the influence court works, veterans court works, mental health court works. That's carrot and stick, and I'm a big believer of that, assuming that you have collaborative efforts of people that know what they're doing. You just can't throw people together and say, hey, we're going to have a court. You got to train them, and it has to be meaningful. But also I want sensible charging. For example, if you look at the municipal codes of cities and counties, local ordinances, you have all these hundreds of ordinances that are misdemeanors, and they don't need to be misdemeanors, a lot of them, for the first offense. I mean, if you've got serial misdemeanors of people repeating, okay, fine. But the default ought to be an infraction, not a misdemeanor, because you've got, you know, people that maybe are taking recyclables, and that's theft. I mean, that isn't, and you don't even get it sealed because it's a local ordinance and it's a misdemeanor. Probably you might be able to get it sealed, but in any event, do we really need all these misdemeanors at the local level, at the county level, at the city level? I want to see fewer cases filed as felonies. I mean, if we know that the person, based upon their record or lack thereof, is not going to prison, and that, you know, if the offense wasn't egregious, why are we filing as a felony?
Well, that's what Prop 47 did.
I hate to cut you off, Jay, but that's going to be the last word. We're out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Our guests have been retired Judge Eugene Hyman, San Francisco Attorney Randall Knox, Chief Assistant Santa Clara District Attorney Jay Boyarsky, and San Francisco attorney and social justice activist Damone Hale. This show has been produced by Dean Johnson and yours truly, and a big thanks to Dean and to our guests for joining us. Most enlightening, and we could continue this conversation for hours. And especially our thanks to all of you for listening in, and at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.